You know, I think it's interesting that Terry talked so much about the state of Israel and what is going on there and the battling that goes on with Hamas, because we always seem as human beings to find a reason to fight one another, don't we? According to the Los Angeles Times, I read an article, it was a number of years back, Mr. and Mrs. Christopher Snyder had a beautiful wedding, just beautiful, but the problems began to start the moment the wedding was over. They couldn't agree where they were to go next to celebrate afterwards. So they had been drinking since probably early afternoon. And in their argument, the bride made a swing at her new husband. And of course, he had bought her this really nice ring with this big diamond. And he missed, she missed, and slipped, hit his head and gashed it, and blood was coming out. So the police were called because somebody thought that he had been stabbed, actually. And when the bride met the police, she became very belligerent with them. And they arrested her for disorderly conduct. Later, the police found the groom wandering around looking for a hospital to go to, and they took him in to see his wife in the jail. And shortly after that, they began her release, and then the argument began all over again. This time, he slapped her and was arrested for domestic battery. Then she started kicking the police for ruining her honeymoon. And they arrested her once again for disorderly conduct. So the newly married couple spent their wedding night in separate cells in a jail that night. They were released the next morning, and nobody knows where they are right now, but you can bet somewhere they're fighting it out. You know, every husband and every wife, it seems, has spats and disagreements from time to time. There are always something to fight about. How about you? When we fight in marriage or when we fight in friendships, how do we do it? And does anything go? In other words, are there no rules, and are we fighting fair or not? Now, I know not everyone is married, and so I appreciate those attending with us over the phone line. I know there's a number of us who might not be married, but I want you to listen to this anyway, because a lot of these principles I'm going to give today apply to us in all kinds of other relationships. But there's no question that there's a crisis in America today when it comes to marriage, is there? They say 50% of all marriages end in divorce, and you know that part of those are people that were married before that the next marriage ended in divorce. Statistically, 50%. In 1998, a study was done in Minnesota, and they did a study to find out the relationship of people after divorce, and they found that the vast majority of them, actually 66% of the people who end up in divorce, wish they had tried a little harder when they were in the marriage and had not gotten the divorce. They wish they would have given it more effort. You know, if you think about in these kinds of fights that go on in marriages, very few think, and ones that especially that end in divorce, very few think about the damage that is done to the children. Their issue is their own selves. They don't think about the kids. But the greatest damage of a divorce is actually done to the children. And I ran the YOU for a number of years, and I can tell you, because when we used to go places, I had my ears turned around backwards. I was listening to them, and I could hear their stories, and I knew what was going on. And I used to listen very carefully, and I knew a lot of these kids were going to struggle with this. And most children struggle all their lives to get over the damage done by divorce. And many of them think they've done something wrong. It was their fault. And they don't ever have the right example in the future to have their own marriage. And they don't know how to solve their own problems because they didn't have it in their own lives growing up. In the book, Love Must Be Tough, James Dobson records a story there that I think illustrates the family problems and how they affect the children. There was a sixth grade teacher who wanted to give her class a writing assignment. And so she gave them an assignment that went like this. I want you to finish the rest of the sentence. I wish. And she was thinking they were going to go for more toys, a television set in my own room, you know, wish, you know, different things like that. But here's what almost all of them wrote, things like this. I wish my parents wouldn't fight. I wish my father would come back. I wish my mother didn't have this boyfriend. I wish I could get straight A's so my dad would love me. I wish I had one mom and one dad like the other kids. Isn't that amazing? I think it is. But it seems that marriage starts off with fights. And the fights develop into resentments, and they deepen into hostility, and they end in anger and divorce. And the children suffer from it all. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 7, if you will. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9, where it says this, Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9, be not hasty in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. In other words, what he's saying is just foolish to get angry over these things that we do. Why not make sure we're not a part of the divorce statistic? Why not make sure that we're fighting fair? Let's go to Proverbs 30, if you would. Proverbs 30. Proverbs 30, pretty close to this. You know, it is natural when people spend time together that there's going to be conflicts that are going to arise. It's natural for there to be debate over things and disagreements in marriage, but they don't have to end in resentment, is my point. The disputes don't have to destroy the marriage. We can fight in marriage, and we can have it end in tragedy. Yes, we can. Jesus said, offenses will come. Conflicts will arise. It's bound to happen. It's going to occur. Here's my issue. It doesn't have to end in divorce. In fact, and this is the truth, arguments and conflicts can end in mutual fulfillment. They can end in mutual respect and admiration. The key to dealing with the conflict is not to avoid the fighting. Fighting is natural, you know, it's normal. But my point today is it actually can be helpful. The issue is to fight fair in marriage or in friendships. You know, it shows in different studies that I've read that people who fight fair actually have a stronger relationship in marriage. And there's an old axiom that says this, the dirtiest fighter is the one who refuses to fight at all. But you understand, the person may not want to rock the boat. They may want to skirt the issue, and they may want to avoid the conflict. But here's the problem. It continues to eat at them. It continues to eat them up. And then others are more bold, they're more confrontational, there are people that are more assertive, and they're people who are good at it, they're good at it, they're good debaters, and they tend to win with their power. But there's always consequences to bear, and so in Proverbs 30 and verse 32, Proverbs 30 and verse 32, if you have done foolishly in lifting up yourself, or if you thought evil, lay your hand on your mouth. Just go, boom, stop, stop talking. Surely the churning of milk brings forth butter, and the wringing of the nose brings forth blood. And in the same way, the forcing of wrath brings forth even more strife. And so you understand my point, that fighting, you may be good at it, and you may tend to win, but when you win, you lose. And we'll talk more about that later. Let's go to Proverbs 25, just a little bit further back. Proverbs 25. Either way, the fighting and the arguing to win our way is never going to work. And the reason is we lift ourselves up against the other, and it brings forth strife, contention, and ultimately division. It is causing division, which God hates. So the point is, hiding from an argument seldom ever resolves the issue. The needs are not ever met, and that is a problem because it irritates and it adds up to resentments. They build, and hostility continues on inside. And it may cause a person, for instance, to distance themselves. You probably experience that. Couples will withdraw from one another. They'll sometimes walk out. They'll slam doors. Outwardly, they seem to be saying, well, all right, I don't like it, but I'm accepting things the way they are. But inside, they're still seething, you see. And they're withholding love and affection for one another. Well, then they make up. But it's like a rubber band. You can stretch a rubber band and it'll come back. And you can stretch it again and it'll come back. And you can stretch it again. But pretty soon, you stretch it, it no longer comes back. It loses the elasticity. And so that's what happens when we fight to try to win. Any material fatigues over time, and sometimes couples can experience battle fatigue, and stretch it enough, a marriage can break. So again, in every marriage, there tends to be arguments. There always will be. But here's my question to you today. Does an argument between two people control them, or do they control the argument? You know, over in Proverbs 25, it says something interesting. Because God's desire for us is to learn to resolve conflicts in love. So if we go off in rages and anger and hostility, what's the benefit of that? Proverbs 25 and verse 28. For example, he that has no rule over his own spirit is like a city that's broken down and without walls. I mean, you're leaving yourself wide open when you go into rages and just become emotional. So we need to be able to rule over our own spirit. And my point today is we need some rules. And so I want to give seven rules, not to avoid arguments, but to learn to fight fair in marriage relationships. Matthew 23, if you will, is the first one. Put the conflict in perspective. Matthew 23. You know, there's probably not one of us that at some times in our life haven't blown an argument completely out of all normal perspective. We've made molehills into mountains at some time in our lives. And by doing this, we're kind of like the Pharisees in this regard. In verse 23, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites, for you pay tithe the mint and anise and cumin, and you've omitted the weightier matters of the law, which is judgment, mercy, and faith. Well, these things you ought to have done as far as tithing, but don't leave the other undone." Well, do we leave the other part undone? Are we like the Pharisees and we omit mercy, judgment, and faith, which are the weightier matters of the law? Back to Proverbs 3. You know, do we sometimes strain at a gnat and swallow a camel? Now, Jesus was talking about when they would make wine, you know, they would take a cloth and they would strain it so none of these insects would get into the wine before it was bottled up. But you understand the point. Christ is saying, you know, you guys, like, you're very careful to not get a gnat in there, but you're willing to swallow a camel, you know? And we're like that sometimes, you know? It's really amazing how the little things can get at us and how this littlest thing can blow us up into an angry, hostile person. So do we do that when we have a conflict with our mate? Do we blow the insignificant into mountains of importance? And in Proverbs 3 and verse 30, it has an interesting comment where it says, "Strive not with a man without a cause if he's done you no harm." Now, I want you to think about this for a minute. Has the other person done you any real harm? See, look, there are things that really hurt us in life, okay? Like stealing from work, that is serious. Driving without insurance, that's pretty important. Drinking too much, drinking all the time. Pornography, spending money that we don't have, you know. Not pulling our own load in the family. These things are pretty serious, and they hurt us, and we should argue about them. But those things seldom occur, actually, in the Church of God. So what do we argue about? Look where you left your socks again, and your underwear over here, you know? And how come the dishes aren't done, you know? And we don't go out to dinner enough. You know, we argue over things that aren't important. They're insignificant in a way because they're not really hurting us. So what happens, though, is we hold these things inside and we hold them inside and then eventually we vent and we explode. Often it isn't about the issue we're arguing about. It's about something else that happened a year ago or 6 months ago or something like that. You know, I have a memory of a chance that I had to meet an old friend, and we used to exercise together when we were younger. And he lived up in Northern California, and I looked him up on the computer, and I made an agreement to meet him. And I was serving a church up near the area, so I drove by and spent a day or two at his house, and I had dinner with Wayne and with his wife, and she said something that I thought was just absolutely remarkable. I still remember it to this day, and it's a very, very beautiful point. You know, Wayne and her, she said, used to argue after they got married all the time. They both worked, and she wanted Wayne to help with the kitchen and clean up the kitchen and stuff, and Wayne agreed. He'd clean up the kitchen. She'd come home, and to her, it looked like a mess. And he And she said, well, I thought you were supposed to clean up the kitchen. And he said, well, I did. And they fought over this over and over and over. I mean, almost every day they'd come home, and this was the battle of the day. And then she told me, she said, one day a light went off. I'm married to a man that helps me clean the kitchen, only the kitchen doesn't have the same significance to him as it does to me. He's cleaning the kitchen to his standards. He's not cleaning them to my standards, but he's cleaning the kitchen. I ought to be grateful I got a man who cleans the kitchen, only he doesn't do it to my standards. And so she began to look at it differently and appreciate what he did do, instead of fighting over what he didn't do. And she said, man, the marriage changed dramatically. You know, to Wayne, a fast computer was important. It's like a 9 or 10, you know? The kitchen is a 2. And so she came to accept him the way he was and appreciate what he gave. And it made a big difference in their relationship. And it changed from arguing to loving. And I think there's an important point in this, and that is each one of us can use this and resolve it by this example. In other words, we got conflicts. But how important is it? See, we never discuss this. How important is it to you, and how important is it to you? And I remember there was a couple, and they had this argument over a refrigerator, you know. She wanted this one. He said, no, we should get that one. And they're arguing back and forth, and they're mad at each other. And finally, she says, the lady comes up to her husband and says, I got a question for you. Scale of 1 to 10, how important is this to you? And he said, 3. And he said, well, how important is it to you? And she says, it's a 9 to me, because I use it every day. And he said, I get it. You know, get whatever you want. But you understand my point, that we'll argue about things sometimes that are insignificant. To him, it's a principle, some principle of how much energy we might get out of it. To her, it's how's it going to fit in there, and how useful is it going to be. We have whole different perspectives, but we don't understand the other person's perspective. We see our perspective, and sometimes that's all we see. And so we argue about things. That's a good little point, isn't it? Put some weight on it. How important is this to you? You know, and why? And if you do that, you can often reconcile with one another and understand one another and make decisions together. We can put it in perspective. It doesn't have to be something to argue about if it's not hurting us. So why fight? Weight the argument. Put some weight on it. How important is it? You know, often the problems will they'll actually solve themselves if we take this kind of approach. Let's go to Ephesians 4, if you would. God tells us this, and he doesn't give us any excuses. He says, don't let the argument go on and on and on, because you know arguments will go on, and people will bring up things that happened weeks, months, or even years in the past. And so it is that God says this, verse 26 and verse 27, profound and powerful words. Be you angry. He knows we're going to get angry. He knows we're going to have conflicts and disagree and maybe even get angry about it. But then he says, sin not. Don't let the sun go down upon your wrath. Neither give place to the devil. Because you tune in. You get angry and you tune in to the prince of the power of the air who's broadcasting his anger and resentment, and you turn right into that channel. And then you begin to pick it up, and then things begin to escalate. And so he says, don't do that. So he admits that there's times that we have troubles and conflicts, but it doesn't grant us permission to sin. And I believe that everyone that gets into a fight or an argument with someone else, eventually some kind of sin takes place to some degree. You know, there's a woman that came to her pastor one day and she said, you know, I'm really having problems at home. He said, I'm so happy to see you, though I haven't seen you for a long time. And so, but, you know, she said things are not going well. And he said, I'm really sorry to hear that. What's been going wrong? And she said, my husband recently died. The pastor said he was so sorry to hear that. And he asked, was it sudden? And she said, yeah, it was. It was very sudden. And the pastor said, did he leave you with anything? Did he leave any last words? And she said, yes, he did leave some last words. And the pastor said, well, what did he say? And she said, Sheila, put down the gun. I know, it's crazy. Anyway, let's go to Proverbs 15. Proverbs 15. You know, we laugh because that's a joke, but it's not a joke. You know that there's been shootings in the church. There have been shootings in other churches. You remember that one lady, that small little lady, married to that great big preacher, and she shot him in the back. Remember that? It's real. This is how far it can go. If we fight each other over something, and we don't get our needs met, the anger builds, the hostility grows, and some people will go postal. And that happens in marriages to one degree or another. And so anyway, my point is this. Sometimes it may seem impossible that things build up and people do irrational things. I don't think any of you are going to shoot anybody, but there's another danger, and that is this. We are willing to call each other names, aren't we? That happens in marriage. And Proverbs 15 and verse 1 and 2 says this, a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words do what? Stir up more anger. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge, okay, but the mouth of the fools pours out foolishness. But man, we're capable of doing that. All we need is a good argument. We can pour out foolishness. Go over to Jude, if you would. I want everyone to consider this next. The other person may be seeming to act like an idiot. Probably they are. Okay? But I want you to remember this. That person is capable of enormous dignity. I want you to consider that if there was ever someone worth naming, calling a name, it would be Satan, wouldn't it? He's the worst person on the face of the earth. And in Jude 1, in verse 9, it says, yet Michael, the archangel, when contending with the devil, disputed about the body of Moses, did not bring, or he didn't dare bring against him a railing accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. But certainly this should be the kind of policy we have towards our mate, shouldn't it? We are no less than the children of God. As such, we command much more respect than Satan the devil. We're the children of God. How can we call a child of God a disrespectful name or put them down? Who do we think we are? You get the point. We don't dare call our mate anything disrespectful. We have no right to do that. It is a sin, and it's breaking the spirit of the commandments, all of them. Doesn't put God first, does it? Takes his name in vain, spirit of murder. You can go right on down the line if you want. You're stealing away the respect they deserve, you know. every commandment is practically broken by that. And so there are things we can do, however, there's physical repercussions from all of this, and to call our mates' names disrespectfully will turn them against us even more. And what do you think is going to do to the children? What do you think it does to them? Does it teach them how to deal with conflicts? Does it teach them how to be loving in a family? No. It hurts them very much when they see this, and then they never learn the right way to do it either. And so it's going to hurt them a great deal, and we ought to think about this. You can think that you could call your mate something like stupid, but it'll back them away. And the real result of the issue of the fight, you know, there's nothing that a person does that really is ever going to resolve this. But such painful darts will poison us for sometimes years afterwards. And you'll get in another argument and they'll bring this up. But it has no bearing on the argument, but it has a bearing on how much do you value me? How much am I valued? That's at the core of almost every single argument that takes place in the Church of God or in the world. You know, when it comes to mates and so on. Those words will come up later, and they'll haunt you, and they'll haunt you. And we've got to not sin in this way. We've got to call each other by affectionate names and not do it, you know, in terms of ridicule, but say honey or dear or things like that to keep it on a perspective that is godly and right. You are beings of enormous dignity, and you are going to be rulers in this world. Right now, you're ambassadors for Jesus Christ. How can we be an ambassador for Jesus Christ and go around calling people names? We need to treat each other with respect and with the dignity that they deserve. And God said, make sure this happens before you go to bed. It's a commandment, and it will make us reach for a solution to the conflict rather than pressing it down and keeping it suppressed. Go to Matthew 18 for a minute, and we'll talk about a point three here. Just think if we handled a conflict between a man and a wife in marriage the way we're supposed to do it with brethren. That is, we've got to respect our mate enough not to spread the argument around to others. So in Matthew 18 and verse 15, it says this, moreover, if your brother shall trespass against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And if he hears you, you've gained your brother. But you understand what happens is that sometimes people will get in arguments and they'll go and they'll tell their mother, or they'll tell their father, or they'll tell their best friend, or they'll tell somebody else, or they'll tell the kids what your father did again, you know. And we've got to not do that. We've got to keep it in-house by going to them and going to them alone. So sometimes it's good to go into another room and talk it over. So Proverbs 25, after God, our loyalty has to be to our mate. Imagine that. The loyalty to your mate, second only to God. And so taking private issues outside without permission is a betrayal of our trust. And God expects us to do this even with our neighbor. And so he says in Proverbs 25, verse 9, debate your cause with your neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another, lest he hear it and put you to shame, and your infamy be not turned away. I mean, man, it's just plain wisdom, isn't it? So if you go ahead and tell you somebody else what your mate did to try to get them on your side, your mate may go tell them something even worse about you. It's just plain common sense. Don't let the thing escalate. Just keep it small and keep it in-house. There may be times to take it to a professional, or you could take it to the church. But it must be understood, if you take your marriage conflict to the church, that the minister there is to act as a consultant. He may be invited in to counsel you, but he may be invited out as well, because the minister has no authority in the family. There is a hierarchy, and in that hierarchy there are categories in which the church has administration over doctrine, has administration over where we meet, it has administration over all kinds of financial matters and all of those things that take place. And it has the authority to put someone out of the church, certainly, you know, if they're causing a lot of trouble. But they don't have authority in the category of marriage. The husband has the authority there, but I remind you that the husband has the responsibility in the marriage to keep the marriage honorable. And so in 1 Corinthians 11, and I remember there were times where a minister would tell a family what they were supposed to do, and they thought they had to do it. But the minister isn't always right. It'd be different if you wore the ephod, wouldn't it? And the light would go off, yes, no, and then we know for sure what how to solve this problem, but he doesn't wear the ephod. But the minister is good to call in because he's counseled 50, 100, or more different marriages. He's seen a lot of possibilities and a lot of things, and he can give good advice. But it's advice, it's still up to the couple to reconcile this together. And the man is the one who is responsible, because in 1 Corinthians 11, it says this profound statement. You know, and people can argue, has God a hierarchy or not? But look at this, verse 3 of chapter 11. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of every woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. So you understand the point that the head of the woman is the husband, not the minister. And I think this needs to be understood in the Church of God better than it has been. He is the authority in the family, but that means he is the one responsible for the family's security, for their protection, and for their happiness. And so some of them misunderstood this authority down through the years. And I remember a man once that I was counseling. He was actually an elder. And this man, when I was counseling, I went to his house. I was there all day, and we talked and talked and talked. And I asked him, his wife would clean up I said, well, her complaint was like she'd clean up the kitchen. He'd come down and make a sandwich and just leave everything there. And I said, well, how do you think that makes her feel? And he said, well, she probably feels like I don't, respect her very much or something like that. I don't care very much for her. And I said, that's right. That's how she feels. And he goes, yeah, but the woman was made for the man. Well, she was, wasn't she? Was she made for him to abuse and use? Or was she made so that man would come to a point where he would learn to be like Christ and sacrifice for her? You understand, if we're nothing but men on the earth, and if we could somehow reproduce like cells reproduce, what would we be doing? Eating cans of beans out of cans with no curtains or window treatments, nothing pretty, nothing beautiful. You understand? We needed a woman, to help us see that living selfishly and fishing and hunting wasn't the only thing in life. So anyway, that's my point today, grand spiritual point. So there is authority that the husband has, but it isn't it isn't just so that he gets his way every time. And the husband who strives to only get his way is denying the faith, because he is to be in Christ's position, and Christ's position is to sacrifice for the church, which he did. And it's our job as men that we go out and battle in this stinking world in order to support our wives. And it is tough sometimes, and we take a lot of garbage from people, you know, and crawl through a lot of muck sometimes in order to get paid so that we can put food on the table. And so it's admirable, but my point is it doesn't stop with just providing. A lot of men think, you know, I work and that's all I'm responsible for. No, we're responsible for the whole gamut, aren't we? Because we're the head. The head, you know, the CEO of a company is responsible for everything, isn't he? So it's his job to, you know, look over the company and make sure it's going smoothly and make sure that the employees are happy and make sure there's not going to be a strike and make sure things are being done with quality control and all of that. Well, a husband's job is to do the same thing, but he's to do it like Christ would do it, and that means in self-sacrificial ways. And so when it comes to, as it says, esteem the other better than yourself, this fits in marriage, that, you know, how important are her needs? You know, so I've gone in cases where I'll never forget when I first came to the church, that I had this, somebody had given me a dishwasher, and there was this Mexican guy, and he wanted to know, you know, he was talking to me, and he said that he wished he could get one. He didn't have the money, and I said, man, I got one. Someone gave it to me, and we have a built-in over here. Mine's in the garage. I went over and installed this thing for him, and you can't imagine how happy she was. But you understand my point is, just think how much happier she would have been if the man would have been stashing a little money aside, you know, privately without telling her. And then all of a sudden, he was the one responsible for getting this for her and getting it installed. And that he had actually listened to her and knew what her needs were. Man, she'd be just stinking beaming, wouldn't she? You know she would. But that's how it's supposed to be. But we are all human, and we all kind of drop the ball from time to time, and we're guilty of this to a certain degree. So again, we're going to make mistakes. And what I'm saying in this context is that women should be able to always come to their husband without fear that it's going to start some kind of big argument. Let's go to Matthew 18 and look at how 18 concludes, because this has to govern our lives, I think, and govern our relationships. Matthew 18, you starts with going to your brother alone, and then, of course, you bring a witness, and you could take it to the church if you want to do that, but finally, it ends in this regard. What's the whole point of going to your brother in the first place? Matthew 18, verse 21. And then came Peter to him and said, well, how often, if my brother sins against me, shall I forgive him? Till seven times? And Jesus said unto him, I say not unto you seven times, but until 70 times seven. And that's the point I make today in this. Are we really doing this? Because if we don't forgive the other, it's an unpardonable sin. God won't forgive us. And so, yeah, we're going to get our toes stepped on, as I say pretty consistently, since I don't know a lot of things to say. I say this consistently. If we're going to dance together, we're going to step on each other's toes once in a while. And so we've got to be prepared to forgive the other person over and over and over again. Because I told, you know, when I got married, by the way, I was told that I had a responsibility of putting the seat down. And I told my wife, I said, you know what, I will put the seat down, but it's going to take me about 5 years. Because, because it was such a low priority to me. I didn't think of it, you know. I had never done it all my life, and now you're asking me to do this, and I really do care, and I will try, but it's going to take a lot longer than you think. You can't tell me today and then expect it's going to always go down every time. And it did. It took a few years, but I eventually put the seat down, you know. And then I ended up in a remarriage, and the new wife didn't put the seat down. Oh, so funny. But you understand my point. It, you know, people will change, and we have to keep forgiving them and give them the time it takes to change. And sometimes it can be a year or more or so before a person can change their way they think or their behavior. So let's give it time, and let's give it some forgiveness when they forget. You always leave the light on. Not always. I shut off once last week. You know. Anyway, four is this. So, and this is so true. I mean, it really is true. If anything is. In an argument, you never want the other person to lose. Many of us argue, we labor under this misunderstanding that we're arguing trying to win. And that's not really the case. And that is why arguments become so destructive. In marriage, there's always one that's stronger than the other. There's always one more aggressive, always one more confident, always one more competitive. There's always one who's a better debater. There's always one who's more articulate. And so you understand there's some that can show their anger real easily, and there's others that really need peace and harmony. And so one can always win over the other. You know, I looked down my block after reading a book called Human Bondage. It didn't have anything to do with bondage, but it was about love, the bondage that loving someone gives us. And I remember reading that book, and then I looked down and he had made this decision himself. He said, you know, I looked down the block, one gives, one takes. You know, and I looked down all the couples all my life. I said, yeah, one's always on top of the other. You know, one always wins and one always kind of loses. And it kind of goes that way through life, you know. And maybe there's a tendency to do it that way. But my point is, what we get in these arguments, and one may use their power to win the argument. And what I'm saying is, you never want to ever cause the other one to lose. Because when you do, you win, but you lose. And you lose because the other one is developing resentment. They are developing hostilities deep inside. And you're going to lose in the end. You know, they may be pressed down where you can't see them, but they're always there. And sometimes they grow. And you can begin to feel devalued. And you take it for a while, but it still eats away at love. It eats at it just like a cancer eats, just like acid eats at something. It will etch it away until there's nothing left sometimes. And so my point is, there's a way to change the fighting environment. There really is a way to change the fighting environment. And that is, we generally have a narrow view of things. I mean, doesn't every one of us always want to do it our way? There isn't anyone that wants to do it the other way. We always think we know best, right? Every man is right in his own eyes. Well, it's the same with every woman. We all think we know best. We all think we have the corner on the market. And so we want to argue our point and we want to win. But my point is, there's a way that they solve conflicts in the corporate world that is really telling. They often have conflicts, and what they'll do is they'll bring all the heads in, all the department heads in, and they'll sit around the table. And what they'll do is they'll bring up what the conflict is. Here's our problem. Give me a way to solve it. Anyway, even a stupid way, In other words, what they do is they brainstorm. So they have a guy who writes down what anybody says. And somebody may say something, it may sound so stupid, the guy, you know, but he still writes it down. And no one's laughing at any of the stupid things that are said, because guess what? Sometimes you'll say something really stupid, but inside the stupidity, there's a gem, a facet that is a great solution if we just twist it a little bit, you know, turn it a little bit over here. So my point is this, is that just think of couples had a conflict and they sat down together and said, let's brainstorm this. It doesn't have to be this way, and it doesn't have to be that way. Sometimes you can brainstorm and try to find a solution to a conflict or a problem within our family, and you can come up with a solution that is 10 times better than yours or hers. You understand the principle? It's really a great idea. But you got to, you know, get rid of some of the emotion. You got to let the other one say what they say without criticizing it. You've got to be able to listen to what the other person's saying, write it down, give it some thought. You can take all these ideas, all the possible ideas, and don't even think about them critically. Just write them down. Then you come back and look at them critically. Ah, now this won't work. No, this won't work. You know, there's a piece to this that is interesting. Let's save this. You know, and you can work together. Now think how life would work if we did it like that. It would get better and better, wouldn't it? And we'd have more confidence in one another, and we'd have more of a sense of unity between one another, and more of a sense of we're working together as a team in this thing called marriage. Well, that's the way I wish it could be. Proverbs 24. So we listen and we think afterwards. But we agree to come up with a solution that is, in this way, always win-win. There's no loser. And that's the beauty of it. It doesn't have to be one way or the other. There can be a way to solve the problem. Proverbs 24:6. For by wise counsel you shall make your war, and in a multitude of counselors there's safety. And that's so true, isn't it? Instead of just two possibilities, a multitude of ideas, a multitude of counsel, there's safety in that. And so you can use this tool in marriage to help solve conflicts by brainstorming. And usually both will find an example that they agree upon. Paul and Barnabas had an argument, and it was such a big fight. But did they say, well, I'm not doing the work then? No. They said, well, I guess they came to a solution that was win-win. I'll take Silas, and you take Mark. And what was the final result? Eventually, Paul writes, bring Mark. He's profitable to me. So Mark was able to prove himself, you see. So they didn't cast the idea out. They found a win-win situation. And I believe that's God's way. Not just a fight and it's me against you and I'm the man, you know. So run it. Run it. Run your play. You know, do it the way that both are winners. You don't want the other one to lose. You want to solve the conflict and resolve it, and you want to do it together. Here's number five. Understand where the fights really come from. Of course, James 4 you're all familiar with, but let's pop over there for a minute and have a look at it. James 4. Verse 1, from where or from whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even from your lusts, that war in your members. You lust and you have not. You kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. You fight and war and you have not because you ask not. And you ask and receive not because you ask amiss that you may consume it upon your lusts. So when I've spoken to couples in counseling situations of what they comes down to, what their arguments are almost always based on are my needs are not being met. And that turns translated into I'm not valued, which may have nothing to do with it at all. They may value you enormously, but just a little thick or just can't do it right now or something. But my wife or husband isn't doing what they should be doing. Therefore, I'm not getting what I need, and I'm not getting what I deserve. And so the arguments and the fights really come from our needs, our fleshly needs that are inside us. We think we have to have things our way, and we think we have to fulfill our desires. And if they're not fulfilled, then it leads to frustration, and eventually human nature, which is never content, the eyes never filled with seeing, the ears never filled with hearing. So my point is that how many times should we ask for God's direction in this instead of thinking, I want it my way? You know, as Christians, don't we want it His way? And so I advise couples to both get down on the floor and, you know, don't hide. You can't hide from God. You know, not really. You know, it's you know, you could try to play that game. And I once did this with my wife. You know, I said, let's get down on the floor, you know, and let's pray about this situation. And she said, oh, dear Father, please have Art see it my way. I thought that was so cute. I said, no, we want to see it His way. But the point is, we all want to have our way, and that's it's just fleshly. It's just carnal. It's just the way we are made, and that's where all the fights come from. And so we pray sometimes, but we're asking amiss, because we're still asking, fill me with my needs, and let's not think about the other ones. And it always comes back to selfishness on our part. And to me, it's a great truth in life. We all want to get our needs met. But the more we try to get our needs met from another, the less the chances are that that will ever happen. It's really a funny axiom in life. You know, the funny thing is, that it doesn't happen every time. I'm not saying 100% or 99%, but at least 90% of the time, if a person really wants to fulfill the other person's needs that they're married to, they will find, if they are putting the other person's best interests at heart, that eventually it will start coming back in spades. You will receive so much more, because God's way is the way of give, and our way is the way of get. So we want to get for ourselves from our fleshly lusts, and God is telling us, give, esteem the other better. And the more we give to the other, the more they're going to say, man, I don't have to be guarded. I don't have to protect myself. I can give myself back, you know, as all fully to the other person. And so just think, if two people are trying to do what is in the best interest of the other one, think what a relationship could really be like. And what happens to the arguments? Oh, no, you take it. No, you take it. No, you have it, you know. That's what the argument becomes, instead of, it's mine, you know, or I got to have this. Number 6 is this over here in Proverbs. Proverbs 21 this time, Proverbs 21, We just should have stayed in Proverbs. And we go there so often. We have to see our part in the conflict. Proverbs 21. And that is the problem. If we don't challenge ourselves, we will generally not see the way we really are and what we're really doing. And so it says, every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord ponders our hearts, what's really going on. And I think there's a point about this. One man approached a marriage counselor with his mate, and he was frustrated the way his wife turned out, and he gave the counselor a list of his gripes. He just listed all the things that she didn't do right or that she did wrong, and the counselor acted a little surprised, and he said he wondered why a man of your intelligence would marry a woman with all these different faults. And he said, well, she didn't have them in the beginning. And the counselor said, so let me see then, you created them? And that's my point, you see, that's my point. We're all right in our own eyes, and we don't see sometimes what we're doing. So a man... this man got a rude awakening, but every one of us have our part, don't we? Before we argue, we need to ask ourselves, we need to listen to what the other person is saying. We need to know what is our part. How are we treating our mate? And an old cowboy axiom, I think, was worth repeating, and it said it this way, a man who treats his wife like a thoroughbred will never end up with an old nag. Of course, it's not never, but we have so much to do with the way our mate treats us. Number seven, Proverbs 17. We can prevent conflict by genuine Christian living, by genuine Christian living. In verse 14, the beginning of strife is when one lets out water. Therefore, leave off contention before it be meddled with. That's a good one. You know, in other words, it's really just saying, stop the fighting. Don't let it ever become some kind of floodgate that just opens out and just pours out all kinds of vile things, you know. Let's strive to live a converted life. You know, Rodney Dangerfield once said, and he and his wife did everything they could to keep their marriage together. Everything they could. He said, everything. We sleep in separate rooms. We have dinner apart. We take separate vacations. We are doing everything we can to keep our marriage together. And that's how it ends up with a lot of people, different beds, different eating schedules, different everything, in order to keep the marriage together. But we are to become one flesh. And the only way to do that is through conversion. And everybody in the world seems to do the opposite to what really works. And that's why the kingdom of God is the opposite of the way this world is. They're all striving to get what they want. And our way has to be the way of give, to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. And I say to take it to a spiritual level. And there is, you know how there's always the physical level and then there's the spiritual counterpart. The spiritual counterpart to me is do unto others as they would have you do unto them. Because men don't understand women's needs and women don't understand men's needs. So if a man does to a woman what his needs are. It's not her needs. It's different. And so I say that we have to do this. We have to live on a spiritual plane where we come to understand the other person and give them their needs. And so I ask us to consider this, that we be serving one another. And that is what God is doing, building a family that is a servant family, that serve one another and do unto others as they need.